Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of the Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. John Allen Paulus. He's a professor of math at Temple University. He's the author of several books, and today we're going to talk about his most recent one, Who's Counting? Uniting Numbers and Narratives with Stories from Pop Culture, Puzzles, Politics, and More. So, Dr. Paulus, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to everyone.
Okay, well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, before we get into some of the topics you explore in this collection of essays, I think we could call it just one initial question. What is innumeracy? Because that's, in fact, the title you give to one of your books.
Innumeracy is just an inability to deal comfortably with numbers. Chance, probability, logic, and everything that flows from that. So it's kind of the mathematical analog of illiteracy. Unfortunately, both of them afflict a large number of people.
So, getting into one very interesting essay that you included in this book, should presidential candidates be tested with puzzles and why? Where does that idea come from?
Well, I mean, a lot of companies test prospective employees by giving them tests, especially high-tech companies. They see, I mean, if they can think logically, if they can solve puzzles, if they kind of are resilient, can think on their feet. And so it's not that unreasonable, that not necessarily to require. I don't know if there's any way we could require presidential or candidates or political candidates in general to take a test, but it would be nice if there was some way of ascertaining not only their ability to think logically, carefully, but even knowledge of certain basic facts. And in this country in particular, it isn't it's people who come across as too brainy or whatever, don't fare well. I mean, in other countries, I mean, Germany, England, people aren't ashamed to say they have a background in science or math. I mean, in Singapore, half the government seems to have so, and Merkel has a PhD or had in Germany and in general. But here, it's almost a kiss of death to come across as scientifically or knowledgeable. But I mean, that's unfortunate. It's a general cultural phenomena. But I think if there was a informal understanding that you have to, maybe test isn't a good thing because that'll scare people, scare candidates. But some way to ascertain their knowledge and some simple puzzles. You wouldn't ask them to solve some complicated brain teaser.
So, talking about science itself, what can be the problem with meta-analysis? I mean, what can go wrong with them?
I'm sorry.
With meta-analysis.
Well, I mean, people will become are oblivious to serious problems because they don't get the media attention or they aren't so sexy or whatever, and people become obsessed with minor problems that afflict relative handful of people, or in terms of money. I mean, millions, billions, trillions. The words rhyme, but they're vastly different, and if you press a hot button on something that costs $50 million, that sounds like a huge investment, whereas $1 trillion is nothing. I mean, people don't realize that a trillion is 1,000 times a billion, which is in turn 1,000 times a million. So incurring some debt of 500 billion kind of that doesn't arouse the same anxiety that spending $50 million does. So, and that's relevant to all kinds of areas. Climate change, people can't put the risks into perspective. Can't in general balance risks if you don't have a kind of feel for numbers, generally big numbers, or even small numbers. Sometimes I asked my class recently, there's a study that says most heart attacks are about 40 some percent of heart attacks occur on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And they attribute this to the stress of the weekend and people drink and they party or whatever. So it's you should be careful because 42% of heart attacks occur on Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. And people, oh, got to be careful. But 3 days of the week is 3/7 of the week, which is about 42%. So you would expect that to be the case. So, I mean, unless you can have some feel for not just big numbers, but small numbers and assess probabilities and likelihoods and so on, you won't be an effective leader. You might be an effective leader because you might be appealing to people who are equally enumerate. One thing that was said about Bill Clinton was that he was actually a very intelligent guy, but he was intelligent enough to realize that he should kind of hide his intelligence and kind of use colloquialism, that dog ain't gonna hunt and whatever. And I think to some extent, maybe in general, but maybe more so in this country, you have to do that.
Another interesting thing that you talk about in one of your essays is how can two losing strategies sometimes result in a winning combination?
It's hard to explain without looking at the actual game. The game involves two games, and you roll a die or flip a coin, and if it's some multiple of three, you go up a step. If it's some other satisfies some other condition, you go down a step, and both of the games played by themselves will result in you're going steadily down the step. You imagine like an infinite staircase. But when you play them alternately, or play first one game, then the other, it's a strange phenomenon. It's due to Pirando, a Spanish physicist. It's called Pirando's paradox. When you play them in succession, one after the other, you actually, even though each game is a losing game, it's actually results in you're going up this infinite stairway. So people have been trying to get some sort of practical application of this, let's say in the market, but there the game isn't as clear cut as it is in this imaginary scenario that Pirando came up with. So far, except in very extreme cases, there's no real application for that, except it's just kind of an oddity, which is, Pirando's paradox.
Yeah. What would you say are some of the most common mistakes people make when thinking in probabilities?
Well, people probably just asking themselves, what is this a random sample? Is it a reasonably random sample? I mean, everybody can go out and ask their friends or look at some kind of partisan website and get the feeling that, their particular biases are held by more people than really are the case. I mean, it's confirmation bias is at play there. But in general, people have difficulty thinking in terms of probability. Their notions of probability or their vocabulary for it are very limited. Sometimes it's not much more than one in a million, 50-50, or sure thing. That's the extent of their probabilistic vocabulary. So, or some people don't even deal with it at all. I mean, I have certain religious people say, well, everything was meant to be, and if that's what you think, you're not going to be too interested or very knowledgeable about probability. And probability results are often counterintuitive, so that's going to be a problem too. But Estimating sample size, I mean, realizing when you've got a random sample or what you have to do, but there's all kinds of little techniques, little ideas that are important. I mean, even just a simple distinction between the risk, between risk and relative risk. Sometimes you read something, the relative risk, if you eat bacon, one slice of bacon a week, your relative risk of this kind of cancer goes up 20%. And people can be, terrified by that. But I'm just making up numbers here. But if five people out of 100,000 get this kind of cancer, and if they eat bacon, if this and that raises the probability to six per 100,000, that's going up from five to six. It is 20%, but it's still a minuscule risk. So there are all sorts of examples where understanding of probability is important. Thing is that probability is just a refinement of everyday notions in whatever natural language you're talking about. Lots of words in English have to do with probability, fate, odds, whatever major, or standard deviation is a refinement of words like very different, far out, strange. So probability is kind of a refinement of these everyday notions. Bayes' theorem too tells you how precisely to change your estimate of the answer in the light of new information. So I mean, people like Molière, people have been speaking, who said people are surprised they've been speaking prose their whole life. Well, in a way, people speak probability their whole life. They just speak it badly. And probability theory and statistics are a refinement of these everyday notions.
Can mathematics itself help us understand a little bit better where the biases and heuristics that people use that are part of human cognition, why they lead us to these mathematical errors?
Well, it's bound up not just in mathematical ignorance, but in, as you just mentioned, various cognitive biases, the availability error, things that come to mind when a story is mentioned. They look at similar stories in the past, anchoring effects, confirmation bias, even the conjunction fallacy. As a more, I mean, the conjunction fallacy is the following. It's originally called a Linda problem. You imagine there's this woman, Linda, who's got a PhD in physics, and she was president of her class in college, and she was, written about feminist issues. Okay, given that background for Linda, which of these two options is more likely? One, Linda works in a convenience store as a cashier. Or two, Linda works in a convenience store as a cashier and it has organized a feminist, national feminist organization. Which of those two things is more likely? And many people would say the latter is more likely. But it turns out that Linda works as a cashier, period, is more likely because it's always easier to satisfy just one condition than two conditions. And the probability of satisfying two conditions is always going to be less than satisfying one of them. And that's called the conjunction fallacy. And it's relevant even in the internet. It's very easy to collect a whole bunch of factoids off the internet and weave them together and concoct this ridiculous story. But it is nevertheless plausible. There's a kind of a trade-off between plausibility and probability. Adding more details, like she's the head of this feminist organization, makes the story more plausible but less probable. So a lot of these conspiracy theories do have a superficial plausibility. There are lots of little details that are true, but aren't really relevant. So, in any case, get back to your thing. Mathematics probability in particular, other areas as well, combined with common cognitive biases, are part of the problem, people seeing things clearly.
Why is it so easy for people to find meaning in random events?
Well, people are, as has often been said, kind of pattern-seeking animals. They want things to make sense, and are always searching ways to connect this or that. I mean, coincidences occur all the time, and the vast majority of them mean absolutely nothing. And but yet, I mean, people. I mean, you can generate them. An example I like is look at the first letters of the months in order: January, February, J, F, and so on. You have July, August, September, October, November. The letters spell Jason. Or look at the first letters of the planets: and Mercury, Venus, Earth, and so on. You have Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. The first letters spell Sun. Is that a coincidence? I mean, is that meaningful? No, of course not. And there are patterns, there are coincidences all over the place. And as I say, the vast majority of them don't mean anything. I mean, even if you get, you know, COVID vaccines, and people said, oh, look at the blood clots. Yeah, there were blood clots after people received the COVID vaccine. That's true. But not any more than there would be in the same time interval for people who didn't receive it. So it's easy to find meaning when it's not there. Same thing as I just said with the internet. Apophenia is a not technical term, but a term for seeing things, patterns that aren't there, and we're all given to that.
Since you mentioned COVID vaccination, and during the pandemic, of course, we've been exposed to lots and lots of different statistics. What do you think we could learn or could have learned about statistics during the pandemic? I mean, things related to base rates, pooling, and sample bias, for example.
Right. Well, false positives, for one. I mean, a false positive test is one that turns out positive when you don't have the condition. But, I mean, and that phenomenon is much more general than COVID. Whenever you test for something that's relatively rare and it's a reasonable test, you're going to have a tremendous percentage of false positives. There are often more false positives than true positives. And the reason is, let's say you're testing for something rare, being a terrorist, let's say. Happily, being a terrorist is a rare phenomenon. But that you have a reasonable psychological profile of terrorists. And if someone's a terrorist, they'll very likely fit that profile. But if someone's not a terrorist, they might also fit it. And there's always a very small percentage of a large number. So to say, I mean, forget terrorism, a disease, a very small percentage of a large number of healthy people will end up testing positive. And a large percentage of a small group of people will test positive, the true positives. But often the former are larger. I mean, false positives are more frequent. It's hard to do. I mean, it's something called radio math or maybe Skype math without formulas or a blackboard or a paper, it's hard to digest if you haven't seen it before. But the notion of false positives, how common they are, the fatality rate in principle is very simple. It's just a fraction, the number of deaths divided by the number of people who have the disease. But both the numerator and denominator are very nebulous notions. How do you know who has it? There's not that many accurate, at least in the beginning, people weren't tested in a small number. And even the numerator, the number of deaths, I mean, did the person die of COVID or with COVID from something else? So that is a problem. exponential growth. What's the difference between exponential growth and linear growth? Linear growth, it grows by the same amount during each time increment, and exponential growth, it grows by the same percentage during each time interval. And the latter case, after a while, it's growing very, very rapidly. So, I mean, people, you know, throw the word around exponentially and often don't really mean what they say. They say something's growing exponentially when it just means it's growing fast. But a lot of these notions are kind of mathematical, and people, I think, you know, because of COVID, people do have a kind of keener understanding of a few of these notions, because they are matters of life and death, as are false positives.
Yeah. So at least in the US, I know that there are certain places where police departments use AI systems to try to prevent a crime. Right. What might be some of the issues with that?
Well, actually, right there is a good example of false positives, because if somebody is a criminal, they probably will test positive, so to speak, will fit the profile. But if you are a criminal, you'll likely fit the profile. But if you aren't, you probably won't fit the profile. But nevertheless, the number of non-criminals is vastly more than the number of criminals. So a small percentage of non-criminals fitting the profile mm-hmm. might be more numerous than a large percentage of criminals fitting it. So you're going to get a lot of false positives. People will be arrested or inconvenienced inconveniences at the very least. So, and not only that, the chilling effect of surveillance in general, which is getting more and more pervasive, and particularly in China, where it doesn't seem like you can go to the bathroom without the government knowing about it. And forget about law enforcement, just the chilling effect of everybody, at least people knowing everything. I mean, there's a controversy on Twitter now that, too many people can see all your tweets and who you're connected with and so on, and can possibly use that in some way to embarrass or, manipulate you.
Mm-hmm. Another interesting thing that I read about in the book, can we learn about the truth from complete liars, that is, people who always lie?
Yeah, well, they're fairly common. It's hard to be a complete liar. In fact, if you had somebody who lied all the time, that would be a very valuable person. You just ask him something, whatever he says, you know, the answer is the opposite. So if you find such a person, let me know. But, there are ways to ask questions that derive from kind of paradoxes. If you have somebody who lies all the time and somebody tells the truth all the time, there are questions you can ask. Let's say, does this road lead to the Capitol? Does this road lead to the Capitol if and only if you're a truth teller? And both the liars and the truth tellers will answer correctly. So, and there's, other sorts of paradoxes. The Smolian paradox, there's liars, truth tellers, and people who sometimes tell the truth and sometimes lie. And that's harder. You can ask two questions and get the correct answer if you pose them in the right way. Again, radio math, it's hard to get across on without thinking about it in a little sample space, so to speak. But lying is pervasive. There's even a way, you can generate, if there's a class of politicians who lie but never tell two lies in a row. So let's look at some sequence of their statements. It turns out that sequence, how many such sequences of statements are there of that sort of a given length? Turns out that's always going to be a Fibonacci number, which is odd, perhaps. And Yeah, so lawyers are an interesting category, and yeah, you can learn a lot about truth by studying lying. There's a number of logical paradoxes. And the liar paradoxes more generally, or more specifically, I discuss in Who's Counting.
Considering the fact that people sometimes lie, is it possible to improve data coming from statistics that involve surveys, for example?
Yeah, I mean there are ways to determine a percentage of people who have done X, where X is something that's illegal or embarrassing. If you ask them, "Have you ever X?" people will often lie. But there's ways to get statistical information about the percentage of people who have X'd without compromising anybody's personal space, so to speak. So, for example, you can ask a bunch of people, "Have you ever X'd?" And if you just ask the question baldly like that, people will lie. But if you tell them each of these people, let's say there's 1,000 people, to secretly flip a coin, and if it lands heads, to just say yes, to answer the question yes, if it lands heads, and if your secret, nobody knows which way your coin landed, if your coin lands tails, then answer the question truthfully. So again, have you ever X'd? Flip a coin privately, secretly. If it lands heads, say yes. If it lands no, answer truthfully. People will be much less likely to lie then, because there's nothing shameful or embarrassing or illegal about flipping a coin and having it land heads. But if there's 1,000 people and you get 560 heads, I mean 560 yeses, that says something, because 500 of them approximately will be because the person flipped a coin and it landed heads. But the other 60, their coins landed tails. So 60 out of that 500, about 12%, have really X. So you have a reasonable statistic. 12% of people have X, but you don't know anything about any individual. And there are refinements of that are used by the CIA, by advertisers. People often don't want to admit that they want this product, but they really do. So there are refinements of that to get statistical measures of something without compromising any particular person's desires.
So, for some diseases, at least like cancer, for example, doctors tend to provide people with information about 5-year survival rates. Is there some issue with that?
Well, it depends. Sometimes, often, the screening takes place too early. I give an example in the book, which may, let's say there's some disease that starts manifesting symptoms in the early 60s and then kills people in a few years. But if you test for it when people are in the, let's say there's two states. In one state, there's 100% screening. And they screen people in their 50s, and everybody survives at least 5 years, because it doesn't affect the symptoms aren't overt until 60. So if you screen people in their 50s, everybody will have satisfy the 5-year survival rate. A different state, nobody is screened. And but so when people turn early 60s, these symptoms come up and they die at the same rate. The state that mandates 100% screening, their people are still going to die within 5 years, and the people who don't screen will of course die within 5 years as well. So that's like a lot of metrics, doesn't always work. I mean, in general, you have to ask when something is defined operationally in some way, is it really measuring what you want it to measure? And sometimes it does, and sometimes it doesn't. So again, you have to understand what the metric is intended to do, what it really does. And not just in medical situations, but in other situations as well. You have to be careful. Does the SAT predict success in college? Well, yes and no, depending on the college.
Okay, so tell us more about that. Do SAT scores really predict success?
Well, yeah, if you look at SAT scores, tests that kids take in high school, achievement tests, it doesn't look like there's any strong correlation between their scores and the grades they get in college. But that's because colleges in general recruit students, attract students from with a narrow kind of range of abilities. And some college will attract students that aren't that good, and they'll have the normal distribution of grades A, B, C, D, F. And other colleges, very elite colleges, will have the same, attract very good students, have the same scores, grades in college, A, B, C, D, F. And the distribution of grades in the two colleges will be the same, but that's because they attract students from different populations. If you take a not very strong students and put them in an elite school, that would make a big difference. And then he or she might have a good chance wouldn't do very well. So, I mean, within the colleges, the grade distribution, let's argue, is more or less the same, but that's because, as I say, they recruit or attract students from the narrowest swath of the spectrum of SAT scores. And if you take one from the top, put it in the bottom, they'll do very well and get all A's, and from the bottom, put it in the top, they might get all F's or D's. Again, you can in the book I talk about a soccer achievement test, and it might become more, anyway, it's also an SAT. what I'm doing in the book is, as you know, I mean, I like to tell stories rather than use formulas and equations, and gets the idea across, in a way that people who are averse to math, will be drawn into it.
Right. Let's get now into some questions surrounding politics and the media. So, can we change people's absolute positions on some topics, like just to give an example, abortion, which has been a big one this year, with mathematics?
No, well, no, but there is a kind of, I mean, you can cite statistics, but no, but the example, I mean, the breaking down an absolute resistance to all abortion, there is a story I like that I think is relevant. Imagine if two things about the world changed. One is because of some natural environment, toxic environment and whatever winds, the radioactivity. Women got women who became pregnant would become pregnant with 10 to 20 fetuses at a time because of these conditions, which toxicity in the environment for one. Okay, so women now, if they become pregnant with 10 to 20 fetuses at a time, and the other is advances in nanotechnology and prenatal care. Doctors can now, if they intervene early, can save some or all of these 10 to 20 fetuses. Someone who's absolutely against abortion in all situations now has a bit of a dilemma, because if they maintain that absolutist position, they have to realize it'll result in a 10 to 20 fold increase in births and what that will do. And they can't say, well, just save some of them, because that'll be tantamount to abortion of the others. If someone, this argument, which is not a knockdown argument, although you might be knocked down if you're giving it in some places, is such that, you know, if once you get somebody to admit, yeah, okay, I don't want that, somebody who's absolutist in their opposition to all abortion, once they, you know, say, okay, in that situation, I would do that, well, then you've opened up the gates and they're no longer absolutists. There's a joke that's marginally relevant that George Bernard Shaw was at a very posh dinner party, and some woman sitting next to him, he was sitting next to some woman, and he asked her if she would have sex with him for £1 million. And she says, why, of course, and she laughed. And then he says, well, would you have sex with me for £10? And she said, why, what do you think I am? She was very indignant. He says, well, that's been established. Now we're just haggling about the price. So once you kind of, yeah, I mean, it's a sexist, marginally relevant thing, but once you, you know, admit a certain principle is no longer absolute, it's you know, everything after that is haggling about the price or haggling about the conditions for an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not exactly mathematics proving anything, but it's on the borderline, so to speak.
Can we understand a phenomenon like political polarization with mathematics?
Yeah, well, there are a number of articles, I mean, columns I discussed in the book. One is Wolf's Dilemma, and it's a real life kind of instantiation of the following. And let's say there's a billionaire, and he says, I'll give 10,000, no, I'll give you $100,000 to anybody who does not press a little button on their desk secretly. Okay, so everybody, there's a bunch of people sitting in a room, there's a button in front of them, nobody knows if you press the button or not. And he says, I'll give $100,000 if no one in this classroom presses a button. But if somebody does, the people who do will get $5,000, not $100,000. And the people who don't will get nothing. So there's an incentive not to press a button because you get $100,000, but somebody might because they're afraid that they'll be betrayed. So in any case, the higher the payoff, the more likely it is that no one will press a button. That's sort of relevant to the lockstep nature of Republicans during the last couple of years, Republicans in the United States who are very partisan and stick together. Because if they all stick together, they get the big benefit, not $100,000, but they get to remain in power, they get all the perks, and that's a huge payoff. But if some of them defect, and say, yeah, what the Republicans are doing is bad or whatever, or I'm not going to support that particular issue, not going to do that. Once the majority breaks, cracks, it might further break. And the people who do that, the Republicans who do that, will get a smaller reward. They might be lionized, praised in the press by in liberal newspapers and journals. But they probably won't. They'll probably stick together because of the huge payoffs. And I mean, Wolf's Dilemma is kind of a multi-person prisoner's dilemma. And it's one reason Republicans, I mean, sometimes it happens with Democrats, but in recent decades, it's been Republicans. And so that's relevant. It's also relevant to, why so many, given I'm talking about politics, why so many people continue to deny that the election was fair, that they continue to deny that, deny that, and have swallowed Trump and other people's things. But there's a quote by Mark Twain that is relevant. Says it's much easier to con people, fool people. Much easier to con people than it is to convince them that they've been conned. Once they've made a decision, it's very hard to go back. I mean, so related to Brandolini's bullshit principle, it's much easier to construct stupid stories that are bullshit, to use his word, than it is to deconstruct them, to refute them. And it's kind of a political version of the law of thermodynamics. But that's another factor. I mean, once somebody publicly says something, it's hard to get them to go back, and their whole identity is vested in showing that they're right, that the election was stolen, whatever.
So, to quote you now, and still in the domain of politics, at a certain point in the book you say, people are conformist and all politics is local, which suggests, incidentally, that political issues and disputes have a fractal structure. So, I mean, with this in mind, does it matter that much if people are well informed on political issues or not? Because that's something that people like political scientists and political philosophers tend to worry about a lot.
That's a good question. I mean, I'd like to think, yeah, it does matter. Because people who are informed, arguably at least, and I'm not certain, but arguably at least, are harder to bamboozle, easier to assemble into a cult if they can't think critically or outside the box or outside what their local politician or local religious leader says. So if you're gullible, the argument is you're much easier to lead and much more likely for some kind of dictator, charismatic dictator to arise. But I hope that's the case. I think it is the case, but there is, you know, an argument you could make that, as you just said, you know, it's people, even if everybody's informed, there's going to be, you know, developments at a higher level that take place at the same as in the local school board, and you're still going to get these kinds of things. And I mean, look at, Germany, I mean, was an educated country and yet gave rise to Hitler and lots of smart people in Russia. I mean, look at Putin and Brazil. I mean, all these examples, and Bolsonaro was elected. Brazil isn't so highly educated, but I mean, there's lots of educated people, but broadly, whereas Germany, and well, especially Germany, not so much Russia. So it's not clear that it's true, but as I say, I'd like it to be true. I guess everybody will. I don't know. Maybe it's a bias, maybe. I don't know. I mean, William F. Buckley, this conservative commentator from years ago, once said that if you took 100 people out of phone book at random, they do just as good a job in the U.S. Senate as the present set of senators. And I don't think that's true, but there is an element of truth to it.
Can we use mathematics to better understand where certain religious beliefs come from?
I don't know. I wrote a book entitled Irreligion, in which I kind of outlined the standard arguments for existence of God and pointed out the logical gaps in all of them. And again, I think if I mean, the reason, I don't know, a lot of people believe in God is that he says he exists in the book that he inspired. Allegedly inspired, which is hardly an argument. So so it's not exactly mathematics proper, but there are, you know, logical gaping holes that are obvious sometimes not so obvious in all of the standard arguments for the existence of God. And if you want to choose to believe, fine, but I shouldn't be bound by what by your particular religious beliefs. You can believe what you want as long as it doesn't directly affect me. But in that sense, again, I mean, my conception of mathematics is broader than that of most people. It's a lot of my work has to do with not the subtitle of this book, Uniting Narratives in Math. I talked about math and humor, the similarities, which aren't so obvious between mathematics and humor. And, they're both logical, although one is illogical. They both deal with patterns. They both depend on the punchline is an aha moment in math, or the punchline in humor. And reductio ad absurdum plays a role in both, although in one case it's for the sake of the absurdum, and the other case is to prove things or disprove things. So, and I wrote a book entitled I Think Therefore I Laugh, which is an exemplification of a remark by Wittgenstein that you could write a good and serious book that consists of jokes broadly conceived. If you get the joke, you get the relevant philosophical point. And puzzles also. I talk about puzzles in this book, some puzzles that generally have a kind of real world significance, but are, kind of interesting in their own right. And puzzles also are on this continuum of math and humor and so on. They're more substantial than jokes, but they're not quite mathematics, but they're certainly relevant, a kind of mathematics. So with this broader conception of mathematics, in that sense, I think math is relevant to religion, math is relevant to politics, and stock market, things that you, any part of your daily life.
So these specifically might also have something to do with religious beliefs and practices. Earlier, we talked about, for example, how people attribute meaning to random events. What about attributing meaning to numbers? Why and how do people do that?
I'm not sure I understand.
Attributing meaning to numbers. So,
you mean like
how does that happen? Why is it that, for example, people, for some reason, focus on a particular number and they think it has some meaning?
Right. Well, there's a long tradition in numerology, the significance of certain numbers, 666, and again, 9/11. Has a kind of status now, but in one of my essays, I talk about how many 9/11, how many situations can be described by 9/11 that come up naturally. The very day of the thing, this American quarterback, Johnny Unitas, died. It was 9 here and 11 there, and there's all kinds of, I don't even remember, but this was 22 years ago or so. 21. But, numbers, people kind of fetishize numbers, as you said, and there's, gematria, different sorts of numerical significance in the Bible, from Greek traditions, Jewish traditions, others as well. And again, it's in some sense, a case of apophenia, kind of focusing on trying to make sense of things and, what unites this, this, and that? 9/11 or 666. Look at this. So, for many people, I think it provides a kind of anchor. How we know those numbers are bad. 13 is bad. Friday the 13th is particularly bad. So, it's like a lot of superstitions.
Mm-hmm. So one last question.
In fact, that number of people have said, I'd like your book on numerology, which is just the opposite. numerology, it's not numerology. I'm against numerology, but I'm sorry.
No problem. So one last question, and perhaps this book of yours is a good example of that, but since mathematics in general tends to be so counterintuitive to most people, is it possible, or do you think it's possible, to make people like and appreciate mathematics more?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it depends on a lot of things, but on how it's taught. And once people are adults, I think, I'm biased, of course, but the way I approach math in numeracy and this book, Who's Counting, via vignettes and stories. It's one way to get across mathematical ideas without arousing this kind of instinctive fear or distaste for mathematics. But I think the way it's taught, getting people to work together, maybe not the straight lecture where teachers at the board and kids have to memorize stuff, and then emphasizing understanding rather than, you know, rote behaviors. And as I've written, mathematics probably has as much to do with computation as literature has to do with typing. Nobody says, oh, you're a good typist, why don't you write a novel, or you're a bad typist, forget that novel. And a broader conception of math, a kind of realization it's related to all sorts of things, getting kids hands-on. I mean, if all you ever did in English class, from middle school, grade school, high school, was diagram sentences and study grammar, it wouldn't be real surprising if when you got to college you didn't have a keen appreciation for literature. You probably wouldn't. But, you know, I'm speaking hyperbolically here, but to some extent that's the situation in math. You study, you know, times tables, you study factoring polynomials, you study taking derivatives of 100 different functions, but you don't get to the kind of literature of mathematics, big ideas that are really intriguing, because you're stuck in this lower level stuff. So I think mathematics can be made much more appealing. And for now, if you're really talented, you don't need that stuff. I mean, education is, as has been said, is most effective when it's least needed. but nevertheless, I think people in general can be grow to appreciate at least mathematics.
Great. So the book is again Who's Counting? Uniting Numbers and Narratives with Stories from Pop Culture, Puzzles, Politics, and More. I will be leaving a link to it in the description box of the interview. Dr. Paulus, just before we go, would you like to tell people where they can find you and your work on the internet?
Yes, they could look up my webpage, John Allen Paulus, A-L-L-E-N, is my middle name, johnallenpaulus.com, and or if they're interested, my Twitter feed, at John Allen Paulus, and or look at my books, all of which are available at all kinds of bookstores, as well as Amazon. Thanks for that question.
And thank you for your time and for the book, which was really fascinating.
I appreciate your kind words and I enjoyed our interview. Thank you.
Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing and to keep the channel sustainable, please consider supporting me on Patreon or PayPal. All of the links are in the description box of this interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights, Learning and Development Done Differently. Check the website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchett, Perga Larson, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunder, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klingby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Henrik Alenia, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Wo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger, Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegger, Rui Narcio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Mark Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernard Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, George Spinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Michael Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernardini, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Cusson, Ivan Bodrenko, Paul Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Haslam Bullitt, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W. João Oeira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yassir Ladeja Araújo, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, João Linhares, Lida Cosmidis, Saima Afzal, Adrian Yeagy, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edin Bronner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortés, Ursula Litzke, Dennis Cook, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Todd Shackelford, Sonny Smith and John Wiseman, My Producers, Ezra Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stefaniak, Luís Caetano, Tom Wagner, Dan Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidi, Sardas Francis, Thomas Trumbull, and Nuno Welder, and my executive producers, Michel Rugieschi, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.